At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall.
The legend of the Banshee is perhaps one of the most well-known historical supernatural entities. Yet, in his new book, author Stephen J. Rolfson covers accounts and witnesses well into the modern era, along with numerous other overlooked messengers of death from around the world. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. And welcome to my latest patrons, Malevolent Matt and Tez Fay. Thank you. And to each and every one of you that continue to support the show, your contributions and support are greatly appreciated. Thank you. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media networks. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and you'll find the link for that in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous art. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Let's now unpick the folklore and history of the Messengers of Death. For many cultures around the world, there is a creature that can turn the bravest of heroes' blood to ice. Be it through a piercing shriek, an encounter with a beautiful woman, or even a doppelganger, the heralding of impending doom or death often leaves many quivering. The most well-known of these creatures is, of course, the Banshee, and joining me to discuss the history and folklore of all these messengers of death is the marvellous Stephen J. Rolfson. Stephen, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters today.
Thank you. I love to be here.
I've always been fascinated by this. Primarily, probably because I think I'm safe, Stephen, because I've got no Irish heritage in my family, so I'm not expecting anything to come a-wailing around me. But I know enough about the Banshee that there are some individuals, obviously, who aren't even connected to the reasons that the creature will often appear or make its presence known, often vocally. But for you, what I've loved about this book that you've created and released for us all is the fact that you have got quite a comprehensive overview of similar kind of legends, beliefs, myths, folklore, and even first-hand accounts from around the world of similar creatures. Because as I referred to earlier, the Banshee is kind of intrinsically linked with people of Irish heritage, even into the modern era. And we still get reports in this day. So what was your starting point? Why did this particular aspect of the weird pull you in, Stephen?
Well, I've been interested in the weird and the supernatural since I was right about 5 years old. That's when my mother took me to see Fantasia, and I haven't been the same since. But I noticed that a lot of people have heard the expression to wail like a banshee or to hear the banshee cry, but very few people actually know much about the banshee. So I figured, well, I'm going to find out because I wanted to know a heck of a lot, too. And this book is the result of that, Beware the Banshee's Cry.
Well, I think it's one of those books, I think. It's often one of those things, Steve, when you see a book like this and you think, why has it taken this long for somebody to pull this kind of reports and beliefs together? And I have to say, when I started reading the book, I wasn't expected to be chilled so early in it, because you obviously open with this wonderful story about these rather dangerous men who ended up getting into a situation which sees one of them awaiting the hangman's noose. And I found that a fascinating story, because it's very interesting, because often, as we've said earlier, people will always kind of tie this to old castles and long-lived families from Ireland and that. But I think there are so many of these stories where you've got people who are the descendants scattered all around the world, because the Irish are well known for being one of the world's great travellers as well, that I wasn't expecting to be terrified so early in such a wonderful book.
Well, yes, what you're referring to is James Murphy in Dayton, Ohio, 1876. He and his street gang had murdered a Civil War veteran, Colonel Dawson, I believe his name was, and he was due to be hanged the next day. And that night, as he laid in his cell, trying to get to sleep, but obviously you're not going to sleep, you're having a big day tomorrow. And all of a sudden, throughout the whole Montgomery County Jail, this is in Dayton, Ohio, incidentally, throughout the entire jail, they hear this woman just screaming as if her heart is ready to break. And to Murphy in his cell, he looks up and he sees a ghost looking at him. And that ghost is his mother, who tried to all of her life to bring him back to the, to the light side, because she could see he was going into the criminal lifestyle. But he didn't listen. She wound up dying. He went his way, and now he had to die. And everyone in that jail, no matter if they believed in God or the spirit or anything like that, they may have been a hardcore atheist, but by the time the sun came up, there were a lot of new believers. And of course, the next morning, Murphy was hanged. Twice, in fact.
Yes.
The dawn rope broke the first time. That is grisly.
Absolutely. I mean, some would say it was a fitting end to such a varmint, Stephen, because yes, he clearly had caused enough problems and pushed his luck one too many times. But I think sometimes we forget about the inhumanity of hanging. And I think Murphy is one of those many people who had the misfortune of being hung to death twice, because there are many stories throughout history of people noose snapping, or the trap door not working, or the, I've seen reports of people where they didn't measure the rope long enough and they've essentially touched the floor and they've gone through. So Murphy seems to be another one of those unfortunate souls that, it makes you wonder, Stephen, because obviously he would have been quite sort of shocked and concussed and probably losing his bodily functions when they made him stand back up to bring him.
Well, he was brave the first time. He was not so brave when they marched him up the second time.
Yes.
And luckily, the second that they had another rope and they were able to do it. And then everybody was talking and everyone was asking, what's this I hear about a woman screaming? And he said, well, his name is Murphy. And there you go.
Yes. But it's good as well, because I think often people overlook the sightings of the banshee creature, Stephen. They tend to suspect that it's always a vocalization that people hear. And yet, I know enough about the history of the banshee to know that usually the person that is chosen to be guided or confirmed that they are about to meet their maker will often see it, whereas others will simply hear it. And this is often the distinction in the banshee myth, especially when it comes to those of Irish descent.
Well, there are a number of cases of people who actually see the banshee, sometimes just seeing it, and other times just hearing and seeing. It's always she. It's ladies' night out. And she's usually about the size of a ball, dressed in fairy colors in a cloak, And almost always, she is combing her hair. Now, she very often will be sitting on the windowsill. Now, as you well know, in Ireland, and I imagine in older houses in England, the windowsills are quite deep. You can very easily sit there, especially if you're the size of Pocky Tina. And she will comb her hair. And that is an interesting thing, and I will wager a number of your listeners, the ladies, will tell you, if asked, when they were a little girl, someone told them, if you ever find a comb on the ground, don't touch it. Don't pick it up. Don't take it. And the idea is, it may well be a banshee's. And she does not believe in finders keepers.
I mean, when you started this particular project, Stephen, were you surprised at how much evidence, stories, witness accounts there are, not just in regards to the banshee, because this is the most famous sort of portent of impending doom, I think. When we talk about such signs, people, I suppose it all depends on where we're from, but the banshee seems to be the one that's transcended nationalities and boundaries. It seems to be the most famous of what I suppose we could call psychopomps, really, because they're all very similar in regards to the fact that large cultures, large numbers of cultures around the world throughout history have always had a similar creature. And yet, when you started this, I would imagine you start with this Irish lore. Did it take you aback to discover that these are still going on into the modern era? Because I think often as well, people suspect that these are the kind of things that stopped being reported 100 years ago.
Well, luckily today, we have folklorists who have gone out into Ireland and collected as many of the old stories. Plus, it still happens today. There are still reports of it. For example, in the city of Derry, there was a case of a person, an old man, who was lying on his bed, and he was dying. He wasn't expected to last through the day. The friends and the family came, and one of the people who was pretty much dragged along was a girl of about 12 years old, and she's sitting there watching, you know, relatives talk, watching relatives praying, crying, you know, the rosary beads were going, and she probably wanted to be anywhere else. All of a sudden, from right outside, she's hearing someone crying and wailing, and then she hears a knock on the door. And she's looking around, okay, now who's coming in now? But nobody goes to the door. Everyone's just going on praying or crying or so on. And it knocks again. And nobody is answering the door. And she's like, what the heck is going on here? I can hear someone outside crying. It sounds like an old woman. Well, it knocks a third time, which is the ominous time.
Yeah.
And she said, well, even though this isn't my house, someone's got to let this person in. No one's paying attention. So this girl gets up and she walks across the room. She opens the door and outside she sees an old hag in a blood red cloak. That being one of the fairy colors. And she's walking away from the house, but she stops all of a sudden, and she turns around and sees, the door's open, and she starts to come, and this girl could tell right away that was not a regular human being. So she slammed the door and fainted dead away. And the next day, of course, the man that had come to see, he was dead. That was her banshee.
I mean, that's quite an interesting thing because there is, as you say, it's very ominous that they sort of announce their presence. Are you surprised that you have, because some people would say that's quite unusual for somebody who's not the person who's going to pass witnessing it arriving or coming to check the address, as it were, Stephen. Were you surprised at how many kind of cases there were like that on top of the actual victim having a visitation?
Sometimes everyone can hear the banshee except the person who's going to die. And I have a case of, it's in Ireland, there is a group of about a dozen bears, and they're working in the field. And, of course, they're getting filthy, as they do that, as would be expected. Suddenly, they hear the banshee crying, and all the bears except one, they all say, "What's it? Oh, my God, it's the banshee. Who could it be? Who's it?" And one of the bears say, "What are you talking about? What are you doing? Are you daft? You know, there was nothing there." Well, after they finished their work that day, they went to where they usually went to clean up it into a stream, and they wash their hands there and such. And wouldn't you know, the one girl who could not hear the banshee fell into the water and drowned. And there was another case in Ireland, very modern. This is probably in the 1970s, of a young woman who seemed to have been a bit psychic. And she heard the banshee one night outside, and she looked, and on the windowsill, there was that tiny woman in, I think, like emerald green cloak, combing her hair and crying out. And of course, she knew immediately it was a banshee, as she had heard one once years before. At that point, her mother came down and said, and she asked her mother, "There's a banshee right outside on the windowsill." She says, "What? Are you crazy? There's no sound. There's nothing. Go to bed. Relax." Well, she did. And the next day, she went to work. She came home. She was walking down the street. Here comes her mother running up to her and said, you know, that a favorite aunt had just died. Mm. The banshee always knows.
Well, it is. I think often this is one of those things that it seems, as with the Grim Reaper, Stephen, that there is no escape for when the banshee makes that call. It's almost one of those, it's just this sense of impending doom. And like you say, often when we look back, people say, "Oh, this must be terrifying." But I think I'd be more terrified because I know if I'm with people and they can all hear something and I can't, that's far more frightening than this ungodly wail that is often associated with it.
There's a case from Scotland. Since you just had a guest on about Scotland not too long ago, I'll throw that in too. There were two girls and a boy. They were walking home from school, and they heard the wailing of, and I will mispronounce this, and former guests will probably be very upset, Dame Meek, who is the washer of sorrows, who washes the bloody clothes of the person doomed to die. Mm. And the girls could see the washerwoman, and they could hear her crying, but the boy, he said, "What are you crying? You're playing a joke on me. No, I'm not going to believe it." "See, no, it's over there." "No, there's nothing over there." Turns out that boy died in a few days. It was his clothes that were being washed by the washer woman.
Mm. I think as well, there doesn't seem to be like a time frame either from when you hear the wailing or you see the visitation, Stephen. Often, once again, this is, I suppose this was one of the difficulties for you when you were sort of researching this, was trying to unpick the myths associated with it. Because I think if you say to people, how long would it take for someone to pass on after they hear or see the banshee, people sort of suggest that it's immediate. Whereas, as you say, and when you read your book, there are stories when it happens, it can happen any point, sort of, it would seem, in the following month. It doesn't happen. I think some people just think, bang, it's done, and that's it. Within 24 hours, the person's going to pass away. But it's not always the case, as that particular experience shows.
It can be. Normally, it is within the same day or 2 or 3 days. For example, there is a case of a woman, I guess kind of a wealthy woman in Ireland, and she's sitting in her parlor one night, I guess reading, and she hears someone screaming outside. A woman is just crying out, and she says, oh, someone's hurt, someone needs help. She calls the servants. And she says, someone's outside, and they seem to be in distress. Do you run out there and see what the heck's going on? Well, the servants look at each other, and they all say the same, thinking the same thing. Am I getting paid enough for this? Well, I guess he did pay pretty well. And, you know, job opportunities weren't that good, so they get the lanterns, they go out, and they look around, and they call out, no one answers. They came back in, and they said, oh, I couldn't find anyone out there. They must have moved on. And she said, okay, well, she went on up to bed. And the next morning, all the servants are there. They had their breakfast, and they're getting ready to go out in the fields or do the tasks around the house. Only the lady of the manor has not come down yet. So, now, what the heck's going on? She's always right on time, very punctual, and they're getting a little worried. So they find the newest maid, the one with the lowest on the totem pole. They say, go on up and tell Madam that, you know, we're all ready for her. And she went up, and she came down very quickly, looking to stop making breakfast for her. She had apparently died that night. The banshee call was for her.
I suppose as well, Stephen, being an American, were you surprised to see the differences? Because, you know, as we refer to, Celtic culture is often sort of shoehorned into covering all the Celtic nations. But when you pull it apart, you can see that there are distinct differences between Ireland and Wales and Scotland and even Cornwall. Yes. And so I always get really annoyed when people say the Scottish Banshee or the Welsh Banshee, because I think they're just misrepresenting that particular strand of folklore, because both countries have their own versions and they don't call it a banshee, do they?
Oh, no, no. In fact, the word banshee that we're using, that's on the cover of the book, is one of about 15 different ways to say it. There's probably more, and it's actually the worst.
Yeah.
It's kind of putting the sound together in one word. It's actually two words, mostly bane, B-A-E-N, or variations thereof, which is woman, and she, S-I-D-H-E, the she. Now, the she is the mound, a fairy mound, not a pile of dirt, but of course, you have those in England and Wales and Scotland as well.
Yes.
And so this means a woman of the fairy mound, which some would say means that she is a fairy. But as we saw in the case from Dayton, Ohio, she could be a ghost. Or, now that I think your listeners will love this, she might even be an ancient Celtic goddess who has, you know, been kind of taken down, no longer a goddess because Christianity came in, but who the heck would want to leave Ireland? So she's still there now as a banshee. And some of the names of banshees connect them to various ancient goddesses, particularly Aine, who was a goddess of summer, fertility, all the good stuff. Abel. They who played the harp. Let me see. Plotha, Plurena. And As you probably seen, I have an incredible story about Cleona in the book.
Yes.
But the goddess most closely connected to the Banshee, and everyone listening is probably seeing it right now, Morrigan, and the great dark death goddess of battle, Morrigan, who is actually three different goddesses. Let me see. There's Nemon, Maka, and Balb. And they combined together to form this really powerful dark death goddess, Morrigan. And she is the one who appeared to the most famous Irishman of all time, Cuchulain.
Yes, a legendary hero.
Yes, a solar hero, and that would get all the academics, breaking pencils in their hands. But I believe that theory of the solar hero. And Samson in the Bible, Heracles. In fact, there are those who call Cuchulain the Irish Hercules. I prefer to call Heracles the Greek Cuchulain.
Yes. Well, there is always a kind of tragic hero in most ancient cultures. Like you say, I mean, Gilgamesh could be another one as well, Stephen, who has a very similar sort of arc.
Oh, yes.
And dances around with all kinds of strange creatures from his particular neck of the woods. And goes on various adventures. And we often have this, especially in Greek and Roman mythology, where people can kind of transcend the veil to try and bring people back after they've been taken and such like. And so
Alcestis.
Yes. So, I'm not surprised that we come across this, because often this is the great thing about folklore that I find fascinating, is that you have these kind of parallel legends where you know that they've both been sort of running for the same length of time. But it's very doubtful that anybody in ancient Greece turned up in Cork, for example, 2,000 years ago to tell them all about Hercules or Heracles, depending on which part of the Greece they were from, and they would transform it. And so when you have similar stories with similar kind of endings, as it were, as though it's almost as if these are universal truths that spread around the world, Stephen.
I imagine that there was once a single mythology in Indo-European culture, and I mean we are back into the Paleolithic era. Back at the time when Stonehenge was, hey, come see what they just built here. And from these we find that there are so many similarities throughout Europe and the Mideast and down into India and such. So this was probably once a single tale that spread throughout the world, and of course adapted to the different environments and the different tribes that settled in places such as England, Ireland, and the Scandinavia.
Did you find any trends as well? Because I know often people will suggest that it's only certain families, especially in Ireland, yes, that would be cursed by these visitations. I know often people say it's anybody whose surname begins with O, such as O'Brien or O'Keefe, or people who are known as McAnally, Max, be it a Merc or a Mac. And often anybody of, I know I've heard reference to, especially in regards to the sort of later settlement of Ireland by Normans and Saxons and people of English descent, that despite the fact that they had, to all intents and purposes, Stephen, they had become Irish, the Banshee didn't consider them Irish, and therefore they were safe from it, despite them desperately trying to become Irish, until they realised they'd become too Irish, and the Banshee said, actually, yes, you're now on the list.
Yes, the Banshee is connected to one particular family, and there are cases where people have heard the Banshee and they say, oh, for my family, and they've actually heard a woman saying, I'm not going to vote for your people. I'm connected to the, I think it was the Hennessy family, and that's who I'm doing. And then someone in that family will die. Yes, in some cases, there are banshees connect to a family, and they consider this something to brag about. This means that I'm from a noble old Irish family. We have our own banshee. Of course, you don't actually want to hear it, but you've still got it. It's still there for bragging rights.
Yes, I used to be, well, I still am, friends with a family who can trace their lineage back to Ireland. They've got a very old-fashioned Irish surname, Stephen, and they've always kind of said, the one thing we're very thankful about is that we had no banshee legend attached to our particular family. Even though they told me, the father told me a few anecdotes over the years, which would suggest that I don't think they're as safe as they think they are. Because they seem to have quite a lot of stories about banshees for a family that didn't seem to have one.
Well, there's also intermarriage.
Exactly, that was my point.
A daughter can marry into, you know, like a Flynn or a Hennessy or an O'Brien. Yeah. And next thing you know, there'll be a pollen for her. Of course, now where you're at in England, there is the Oxenham family with the white bird. Now, they're located down in Devon.
Yes.
Which I believe used to be called Devonshire. That's the one part of England I would love to visit if I could ever get back there.
Yes.
But there's a kind of a really neat story about this particular English death messenger. There was Margaret Oxenham, and she was ready to be married to a young man. And turns out, before the wedding, he had probably a carriage accident, hit his head, and at that point, he went completely insane. I mean, he could not take care of himself. Obviously, he could not marry. And she was very sad because she really wanted to marry him. But, okay, he's been taken care of somewhere else. She found Sir John Rokesenglaive, and they decided to get married. Now, on the day that she's supposed to be married, she's getting ready in the bride's room, maybe saying a prayer, looking at herself in the mirror. And suddenly, here is this apparition of a bird, a large white bird over her head, and it vanishes. And she says, this is not good. And she goes on, she walks down the aisle with her soon-to-be husband, but all of a sudden, who should come in but the man who had gone crazy she was supposed to marry before, and he runs up the aisle, and before anyone can do anything, he pulls out a knife, he stabs her, and then he stabs himself, and they both fall dead there at the altar of what should have been her wedding. And ever since then, a white bird has appeared before one of the heads of the family passed away.
I mean, yes, that's not the kind of ending you want in such a situation. I mean, it's one of those as well that often there's a high level of tragedy involved in some of these stories as well, Stephen, isn't there?
Yes, I think Lovecraft would consider that a comedy, but yes, that's a very tragic tale, and it's still going on.
Yes, I mean, that kind of reminds me of one I remember reading about a few years ago, which is from Sri Lanka, and they have something, I think it's called the Devil Bird?
Yes.
And that works on a very similar situation. Obviously, this seems to be one of those where the cry of this particular bird is supposed to foretell the passing of somebody once again. And so it's interesting how certain animals get attached with these powers or these ability to predict future events, Stephen. Yes. Regardless, like you say,
what you're talking about is the Ulama.
Yes.
It's also known as the Rakurilla or the Everbird, and this is an even more grisly tale than the Oxenham. It was the case of a husband and a wife, and the wife gave birth to a child, but the husband was crazy and he thought, maybe this is not my child. Maybe my wife has been unfaithful.
Mm.
Well, one day she was off to the market or such, and the baby was there in miscare, and he killed the baby. And I won't go any further than that. You'll have to read the book because I don't want to make this too unpleasant. But when the wife found out, she was not happy that her baby was dead. And she went running off into the forest, and which, of course, would be the jungle. And she was turned into this screamer, the Ulama. Now, there are also bird death messengers in New Zealand, which is called the Hakamai. And then down in Brazil, there is a thing called the Ulapau, which is another death bird. And this was another tragic case of love that didn't work out. The girl was in love with the guy, but the guy didn't like her.
Hmm.
So the father of the girl said, okay, let's do this. He killed the guy. Then when the girl found out that what her father had done, she once again, she went out into the rainforest, and she was transformed into the death bird.
I mean, there is often that as well, that certain cultures, it creates, a tragic event can create that person becoming the messenger of doom, as it were, Stephen, which I've always found a very interesting aspect to this. It's almost as if grief transforms them into becoming that messenger going forwards, which I think is quite a sad end to people that have suffered a tragedy, because it's not really their fault that they've ended up in the situation that they have often.
Well, a case like that would be one of the most famous banshees of all time, the one seen by Lady Fanshawe.
Mm.
And she was in a castle that was owned by the O'Brien family. I'm trying to think what county that was in. That doesn't matter. And in the middle of the night, she has woke up by a lady screaming outside of the window. The weird thing is, she's on the second floor. And there's a moat. This is a real old castle. Even has a moat with water. And she looks out the window, and here's this Irish girl in fairy green with long red hair floating in the air and looking in the room. No, looking at her clothing and such. Well, I guess just the fact that you've been dead a few hundred years doesn't mean you can't keep up with the latest fashion. And then the lady floating in the air screams again. She floats backwards and screams a third time and vanishes. And Lady Fanshawe says, okay, time to go back to bed. I don't think I'm getting much sleep tonight. And she went to bed. Next morning she went down. She spoke to her host and said, told her what happened. And he just nodded sadly and said, yes, that is the family banshee. It turns out that we had a member of our family in the castle last night who was very ill and passed away. Now, the story behind that banshee that you saw, centuries ago, one of the young men of the O'Brien family made a peasant girl that he had happened to fall in love with. Now, as we all know, back in the medieval times, it wasn't like you see in a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Yes.
You married for a political gain, for, you know, to make a treaty or such.
Yes.
Well, everyone gave this guy so much grief that he said, okay, I'm going to take care of this. So he had his young wife drowned in the moat. Now, personally, I think it's a little worse to murder your wife than to marry beneath your station. But I guess they thought of things differently then. And ever yeah. since then, she had been coming back as a banshee. And I bet she just loved telling people you're going to die.
I mean, that's an interesting aspect to the banshee mythology, I think, Stephen, because that is a prime example of a terrible end coming to someone who then, it's almost that's the audition they passed to become a banshee. And so you would suggest that such women, as you say, who were terribly mistreated because for no other reason other than where they were brought up and where the families they were born in, as you say, that they were denied access to marry above their station, as it were, as it still can sometimes be frowned upon in all kinds of circles, even in the modern era, Stephen, sadly. And so I feel sorry for her, but I'm sure, like you say, I'm sure she took great delight in terrorizing that family for the rest of all time.
Yeah, I have about three or four instances like that in the book. I can't think of one right off the bat, but yeah, I know I've got some in there. I'm thinking this is kind of a motif. This is a repeating story that I keep running into here.
Yes, I think what it tells us is that a lot of men in those days were shits, really, Stephen, and needed to treat people better.
Yes, the standards were definitely a little bit different in medieval Ireland, yes.
Yes. What I often find peculiar about this is often the kind of explanations that sometimes get forward, especially in Ireland, that people, as can often be found when it comes to folklore, Stephen, that people of a certain slant will dismiss folklore as the imaginations of stupid people who don't understand how things work. And when it comes to the banshee, that they don't understand what keening is. And so I know what keening is because, you know, I'm aware of how it works. I think a lot of people would be surprised, even though I suspect it still goes on to this day, but perhaps not to the level we could suggest that you would see in older days, where people would employ professional mourners who would wail and shriek and cry at the deceased's funeral as though it was the worst thing that could ever happen. And that seemed to go on, especially in Scotland as well as Ireland, that you would have professional mourners who were known as keeners.
This is, I believe it is still existing, but you have to go way out, maybe like in County Donegal, where a lot of the old traditions are still in effect. But yes, the Catholic Church really frowned upon this because these mourners were paid. Many times they may not have even seen the person they're mourning even once in their life. You know, and they probably wouldn't give them the time of day if they had. But here they're getting paid, so they're going to put on a good performance. And here we go. Thank goodness for folklorists, because they have been able to capture on tape some of the actual keeners and their wailing, and which sounds exactly like the banshee. So the two are very closely connected there.
Yes. There's also that weird strand of keening as well, where you certain communities would have a professional keener, Stephen, who seemed to,
yes.
If somebody in the village or the local community or lived in the farms around the area had passed away, it would be the village keener who was told, and she would sing a song that everybody then would be able to hear in the local area to announce the death of someone, and they would then congregate to discover who had passed, which I find a very strange way to alert your community.
Well, in fact, yes, but it wouldn't be done today. Today we have these little phones in our hands, so everyone just moves instantly. Yes.
When you were sort of spreading your eyes further afield, were you surprised how many cultures have similar stories, Stephen? Because I know, I believe the Germans have one whose the basic translation is the White Lady. And there are
the
other
Weisse
versions.
Frau.
Yes, the Weisse Frau. Yeah. And so you have numerous ones. Were you surprised that they all, they're similar, but they're also quite different? Because straight away, the German version is a beautiful white lady, often with blonde hair, when in descriptions in Germanic folklore, which is obviously different to what we see from Ireland, because usually they're wearing green, occasionally red. But there, it's a very distinctive sort of look for their particular version.
The Weisse Frau is very similar to the Banshee, but of course, she's always a woman, but the Weisse Frau will appear inside of a building. This almost never happens with the Irish Banshee. The Weisse Frau will be connected to a prominent family or a moderately prominent family. And the example I give in the book is the Hohenzollerns. Those familiar with history know immediately this was the ruling family of Germany for about 600-700 years. It ended at the end of World War I. Kaiser Wilhelm II was one. They had a Weisse Frau, and there was a case in the, I believe that it was Schloss Neuhaus, the new castle. And a princess of the Hohenzollern family was looking in a mirror trying on a hat. And she was just, admiring herself. And she saw out of the corner of her eye someone walking by. She figured it was one of the servants. And she just casually asked, "Oh, what time is it?" And suddenly she heard a ghostly voice say to her, "It is 10 o'clock, my love." And she turned around, and here is this skeletal creature dressed in white, almost like a wedding gown, and giving her this evil look and grin, and then vanishes. And within a few days, that particular princess went to join her ancestors.
Well, what strikes me as well about German folklore is that they seem to have another version, which is known as the Klagemumme, which I think means wailing auntie, which is a
wailing auntie.
But
there's also a wailing mother.
Yes.
I think the Klagemutter would be the mother. Oh, my German just abandoned me. But there's one for wailing. But yes, that is very similar to the Irish Banshee.
But what strikes me about that one, she seems to be one of those that appears as a animal. Because I know there are stories saying that she appears as a large black dog and even a goose.
There are a number of death messengers throughout the world that appear as animals, what we sometimes call a fetch. Now, to give you an example of this, 2 days ago, I was at the main library here in Cincinnati and signing books, and I would tell people, believe it or not, from where you're standing right now, two blocks in that direction, there was a case of a banshee. And in this instance, it was, that's where the city hospital was, and the banshee showed up in the form of a black cat, how fitting. And the cat was pretty much adopted as a pet by the staff, the doctors, nurses. They all loved the cat. But then they noticed every now and then the cat would suddenly just go absolutely insane, go around in the circles up in the air, screeching and hollering, and then stop. And as soon as that cat did that, someone in the hospital had died. Eventually, the cat left, and no one was sorry to see it go.
Yes, there are obviously stories like that in the modern era. I know there have been stories about puppies or dogs and cats, especially in old people's homes or hospices or whatever, who are like the center's pet, Stephen, and it seems to have this terrible reputation, or it seems to know. And you often think, is this kind of thing where it's people start to think, oh, well, we saw the cat in that room and then that person's passed away? Or is it, well, we went in the room and that person had passed and the cat was on the bed? Sometimes I think it we sometimes get the version of what is going on that's been slightly blurred, as it were. I'm not disputing. I think, especially when it comes to animals, we know that they have senses that we can't even sort of comprehend often, especially when it comes to cats and dogs. And if anybody was going to be able to predict things, I mean, obviously, in this day and age, we can train dogs to sense when people may be about to have an epileptic seizure or if they need their medication. Yeah. They can smell things that humans, no matter how well we're trained, we have no concept of the changes in a body's aroma, as it were, and yet animals are able to spot that.
Oh, yes.
I would not be surprised if the cats and dogs have that kind of ability to be able to sense the sort of biological changes that occur before someone passes over.
Well, try this one. Now, this is an instance that I do not have in the book because I read it in a book years ago. And I mean, I've read thousands of books in my lifetime. And it concerns a family, an Irish family, living in Massachusetts. And this was in, you know, they had been in the United States for like four or five generations. And all of a sudden, one day, a German shepherd comes into the yard. And he starts playing with the children. And he doesn't want to leave. And they feed the dog, give him water, and they play with him. And they love the dog, except the grandmother. The grandmother wants nothing to do with that dog. And a few days later, they get word from Ireland that one of their close relatives had just died. And when they went out, that dog was nowhere around. And the grandmother said, I can't believe I have, you know, descendants this dumb. That dog was a banshee.
Clearly, those messages and that knowledge had not been passed on to the younger generation, Stephen.
Oh, no, that's the modern world, unfortunately.
I think one of my favourite kind of animal-related portents is also from Ireland, which is the Gormaston family and their strange relationship with foxes. Because this is one of those stories, because foxes were often demonised. I mean, thankfully, it's been banned here in the United Kingdom, fox hunting, to all intents and purposes, though there are certain people who still try to indulge in such a barbaric sport. But, well, you can't even call it a sport, regardless. And yet, this story seems to date back nearly 400, 500 years, where I believe the Lord Gormaston of the 1600s decided on a whim that on a particular fox hunt, he would not kill a vixen and her cubs. And therefore, the foxes believed that this was a sign of respect or charity or whatever. And from that point on, they became the family's pallbearers. And if anybody was on their last legs or had passed away, Gormaston Castle seemed to become a magnet for all the local foxes.
The foxes would actually walk right through a chicken yard and not stop for a snack. And then they would go to the door of the manor, and they would just raise all kinds of sounds, you know, yelping, whatever sound a fox makes, I can imagine must be unsettling.
Yes.
And And there was this weird case. Now, in 1940, there was that horrific Battle of Dunkirk, in which one of the Gormanskins died, and the Foxes were there. But then the Gormanskins came home from the war, but one did not come. He was missing. But the servants were saying, no, the Foxes haven't come. He's still alive. And the family waited until 1952. And then the lady who was his wife went ahead and married someone else. And then it wasn't much longer. He showed up. He had had a mental problem and amnesia. And he only recently was able to come back. Oh, yes, I'm supposed to be in Ireland.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my very favorite ones. That one's in the book. I love the Gormanston one.
Yes, it's one of those that it's kind of frightening, but it's also quite it makes you feel a bit warm and fuzzy that we have this kind of cohabitation relationship between families and foxes, as though there is this unspoken or unyapped agreement, Stephen.
Well, foxes are often considered to be supernatural, very closely aligned to the supernatural. You can say, especially in Japan,
yes,
where you have the fox spirit.
Yes, absolutely.
And sometimes people have a fox spirit and they're able to work spells and stuff using that particular spirit.
Yes. I'm also intrigued by it's not just animals or ghosts or spirits that sometimes can predict or announce an oncoming death. Whales is this wonderful, well, I suppose it depends if you see them or not, Stephen. I'm using the term wonderful, where they have these wonderful things called corpse lights.
Yes.
Which is interesting. Were you able to find variations of this around there? Because obviously the corpse candle is a very specific one to a particular region of Wales as well.
I mentioned that in the book. Probably next to Ireland, I have most of it from Wales. There's a lot of really gloomy things. There's a case of a bunch of young men, maybe about four or five, and they're going out to do a little mountain climbing in Wales. And as they're walking along, they saw a fire in the house of the ferryman. And they go running down to help to see to get the family out, help put the fire out. And the house is fine. There's nothing wrong. And they go on their way. They're sitting in a pub with some other mountaineers from another group. And they said they saw the same exact thing. The same thing happened to them. Well, they all go on their different ways. They climb their mountains. They come down. They come back. The house is burned down.
Hmm. Which is not what you need, Stephen, at all.
No. No, you were speaking of animals. One rather amusing tale of a animal spirit called, and I will mispronounce this for your benefit, Fjelja from Scandinavia. They can be like a banshee. If you have a dream of this woman with long hair riding a gray horse towards you, that means you're going to die.
Mm.
Sometimes a Fjelja will take the form of an animal. And there is this interesting instance of a 8-year-old boy running into a room. Of course, an 8-year-old boy is always going to run. They don't walk anywhere. And there's an old man sitting there. And all of a sudden, the boy just falls right on his face. And there was nothing there. And he gets up, and the old man is just laughing himself crazy. And the little boy shakes himself off, gives him a dirty look, and walks out another door angry. But later on, he comes back, and he said, okay, what happened? I didn't trip on air. How did I wind up going down? And the old man says, you couldn't see it. but your food juggles with you in the form of a white bear cub. And when the bear saw me, it stopped suddenly, but you didn't stop, and you tripped over your own food jug.
I think one of the strangest stories you mention in your book, and I'd never heard this one at all, is this odd story that comes from Italy about the family who had a son who was gravely ill in bed, and despite their wealth, they couldn't do anything to help their son. And this particular night, a disembodied head started sticking through everybody's doors, rousing them. And I found that one a very odd one, because that's a very unique story, Stephen.
Yes, the head of the family grabbed the sword. He's running up and down the hallway. The servants are out looking around. It's a case of duck, duck, goose. There was nobody around. And then the next thing you know, the child died. Now, even weirder than that, and one of these is from Scotland, is when an arm comes through the wall. And sometimes it makes a racket to, attract your attention, as if an arm coming through the wall is not going to attract your attention. It has to knock over a lamp in the process. But that is also one of the death messengers. I think the one in Scotland is called the Bloody Hand.
Yes, yes. There are some strange variations of this. And I know one of the other aspects of this particular phenomenon that people have started to sort of open up to is also doppelgangers, Stephen. Because this is another thing that seems to permeate cultures all over the world, because often people will use the term doppelganger for all kinds of things. A voyager is not the same as a doppelganger, and vice versa, because one usually means somebody arrives before they do, whereas a doppelganger is confusing for some people, because it also leads into something I really like, which are crisis apparitions, where people thousands of miles away see a relative or a loved one appear at exactly the same time that they're passing. Whereas a doppelganger seems quite specific, because as with anything, as we've mentioned about people who see the banshee, they're in big trouble. Usually the people that see the doppelganger are as well.
There is a painting, and I can give the listeners a homework assignment. Look up for the images on the computer. Look up Rossetti's famous painting, How They Met Themselves. And you'll see a painting of a man and a woman, a young man and woman, off for a stroll in the forest, probably going to have a little stolen kiss. And suddenly they're stopped by themselves. You see the exact same people looking at them, blocking their path. And the doubles have this weird glow around them. And the guy is pull the sword out, the woman is fainting away, because they know when you see yourself, that means you are going to die. Most famous one of this being Percy Shelley, the great poet. Before he drowned in the Gulf of Spezia in Italy, some friends of his were having dinner in a cafe, and they saw Shelley just walk by the sidewalk. And they called to him, "Hey, Percy, why don't you come up and join us?" He kept going, and they figured, well, he was, busy with something. And then he comes up again. Now, this was impossible. There's no way he could have gone around and circled around and come up a second time. Says something is not right. And within a few days, he went out ill-advisedly in a very choppy water on the Gulf of Spezia. His boat overturned and he drowned.
Yes, yes. I mean, they are often peculiar, because I believe doppelganger means double walker or something. Yes. I think that's what the German is. And so, once again, the Germans have a lot of words that have moved into the spiritual dictionary, it would seem, for all kinds of phenomena. Yes, all kinds of things. And so when you look at this, I'm surprised how many times this turns up in Scandinavian folklore, Stephen. It seems it doesn't matter what part of Scandinavia, whether it's Sweden, Iceland, Norway, Denmark, Finland, they've all got stories akin to this particular phenomenon. And so it does seem very sort of Northern Europe based, but as you describe in the book, there are stories from all around the world. But it seems that the origin of these doppelganger kind of reports seem to sort of emanate from Scandinavia, Northern Germany.
Of course, you also have the Ikkyo in Japan, which is essentially the ghost of a living person. And during the Second World War, there were a number of cases of families in Japan. Suddenly, their son, in his military uniform, would appear before them, and they weren't happy to see him because they knew what that meant. And a few days later, they would get word that their son had died in some battle somewhere.
Yes. One that I'm aware of, but not the version you mentioned in the book, is this Welsh miner legend, which is the Clydrith, which is miners would often see a colleague when he shouldn't be there, which would usually mean that that person was either about to die or had just died. Where I grew up, there was a lot of mines. I've heard similar stories from Yorkshire in regards to it was bad luck, or you would see, as we were referring about the corpse candles earlier, Stephen, you would see lights dancing about in certain areas where the following day or the following week there would be a fatal accident, or you would see the corpse light dancing above a miner's head, and not just the reflection of their lamp, obviously, and that would often signal it. And the Clydrith seems to be one of these that, once again, you have people working in confined spaces. Seeing something like this, I suppose, would be quite relieving for some of them, being selfish, because they thought, well, it's not me that's going to die in this particularly awful accident.
There are also a number of cases from Wales, and I imagine probably from Yorkshire, of people hearing the sound of either a funeral or the sound of a coffin being made or of a body being carried into a house after the accident. I have a few cases of that. I wish I could have done more about Wales. There's so much rich material in Wales. I shouldn't say that because that might be an upcoming idea there.
Well, I think, to be fair, Stephen, Wales gets overlooked a lot in regards to its folklore and its history. And so when I was reading your book, I was delighted to see as many references to Wales, because I think often, especially when we're talking about this particular subject, people seem laser focused on the Scottish and the Irish and the crossovers. But like you say, when we look at your book, you've got tons of stories from Wales. You've got stories from England, as we've mentioned, Sri Lanka. We've got Germany. We've got Scandinavia. You've got Japan. It's incredible, really, that there is such a variation of this. And it shows you, as you refer to there about the Welsh history and legends, how much more there is out there that we just need to scrape away. Because often I think a lot of these wonderful stories get lost because they're not in English.
Yeah, it is. That is a problem in folklore, is that as each generation passes away, sometimes the lore does not move on to the next generation. And today, with social media and, you know, streaming and such, are young people as ready to sit and listen to the old tales and pass them along to their children? Yes, that's why it's so good to have folklorists who can run around and collect these stories before they're gone forever.
I suppose as well, one of the other chapters focuses on other sort of messages or notices from the other side in regards to the passing. And a wry smile passed my lips when I read the section where you mentioned mirrors, Stephen, because I remember as a child going to a house about a few days after somebody had passed away. And I'd been a visitor to this house previously, so I knew, you know, I could remember what it looked like and everything. And when we walked in, there always used to be this big mirror at the foot of the stairs. And on this particular visit, the mirror was covered with a blanket. Yeah. And when I asked, they said, oh, no, it's broken. We don't, because I was only like seven. I said, oh, what's wrong with the mirror? I said, oh, well, it's broken, so we've covered it up so it doesn't hurt anybody. And then when we left, because my family knew I was a bit strange and I was into these weird things, as you said, Stephen, from a very early age, they said, oh, yeah, they've covered it up just in case the ghost gets lost in the house. And I think those kind of traditions, I love those, because lots of people seem to have forgotten about these wonderful little weird things that people used to do after funerals.
The last, I think the second last chapter, might be the very last chapter in my book, deals strictly with death omens and superstitions. And yes, mirrors must be covered up. Clocks must be stopped. But not for the time when they're at. They must be stopped at the time when the person died. And there's a whole lot of superstitions. For example, you should never count the number of cars in a funeral procession. Now, why you would want to, I have no idea. But if you count the cars, you might be riding, you know, in one very soon. Possibly right at the very front, so don't count funeral cars.
Yes, but I think it's one of those things. I think often we don't realise how often some of these beliefs or sayings have integrated themselves into culture. I think everybody has had a situation where we've shivered, Stephen, and somebody goes, oh, somebody's walked over your grave. And these were real beliefs. They weren't, they're not just sort of turns of phrase. Usually that was a bad sign.
And sometimes they say a cat walked over your grave, because cats are supposedly somewhat connected to the other world.
Mm.
As we saw in the Cincinnati hospital.
Yes. I was very disturbed as well to hear that in Vermont, sneezing before your breakfast on a Sunday is bad news as well, Stephen. That's terrible news in the summer if you've got hay fever.
Yes, and I imagine in spring in Vermont, you would be doing a lot of sneezing.
Yes, antihistamines must go through the roof in Vermont, one would suggest, yes. Stephen, because nobody wants to be sneezing on a Sunday, by the sounds of it.
No, yeah, of course, my source on that one was an article written in the 1800s.
Mm.
So that superstition may not still be around. But others do. For example, in my own household, on New Year's Day, you got to do all your laundry on New Year's Eve and make sure that you're caught up on your clothes, because New Year's Day, you don't do any laundry because you might wash out a member of the family.
Ah, we have a similar, well, it's similar. We have to do something here in England, especially in my family, where we have to let the new year in and let the old new year out. So we have to come in with a piece of coal on as the clock strikes 12. Someone has to say, you know, even if it's you, I have to go outside with a piece of coal, Stephen, and knock on my own door to be let in. But we have to have the back door open or a back window open. So as you enter, the old year goes and takes everything with it. So it's essentially to cleanse. So it's very similar, but you're sort of cleansing the spirituality of the house and the family rather than the actual physical laundry. But it's a very similar thing. You're cleansing, you're cleaning, aren't you?
Yes. Now, in my household, we take silver, which would be coins. We pretend it's silver.
Yes.
And we put it on the windowsill out and by the front door. I like what you said. I think this coming New Year's Eve, when we're out making all the noise on the porch, then someone's going to have to open up the back door and take all the bad luck and send it out.
Absolutely. Very much so. Toast it away, Stephen. Send it on its way. I mean, before I let you go, Stephen, what is your belief now after starting the book to finishing it and releasing it into the world, as it were? Have you found a bigger thirst for this particular thing? Because obviously, as I referred to at the beginning of our conversation, you're someone who has written extensively about local history and a deep love of that particular subject. And so you've managed to couple both loves of history and the supernatural together for this particular book. Has it given you a thirst to explore any other strange traditions or creatures of this ilk?
Well, I can't tell you exactly what I'm trying to cook them right now because my IT department will reach for a blunt object. But let's just say we're going to get a lot of really weird stuff from me.
Oh, well, I look forward to that because I thoroughly enjoyed reading this because I love a book that pushes the boundaries and doesn't just stick to the normal things. And obviously with this book, as I say, yes, the title and large portions of it refer to the Irish legend of the Banshee, but also the fact that you've taken the time to look into some other aspects of this from other countries that, as is often the case, would be overlooked or perhaps not considered in the same value as the Banshee legend, Stephen.
Actually, I could have added at least another 100 pages onto this book, but I had to fight with my editor to get it as it is. And you probably noticed, because it's a bit larger than most of the development books. And, I was on the road, but unfortunately, I had to have it cut off.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's certainly, you could never describe this book as being like a pamphlet, Stephen, by all, no mistake.
No.
But it's well worth it, because like I say, you've clearly put your research in and pulled this together. And so I think anybody who's got an interest in folklore that they may not be aware of, as well as their love of particular Irish legends and myths and stories, would be well versed to get a copy of this, because I think when you find a book that tells you about things that are outside of the normal parameters for this particular phenomenon, it's worth every penny of it, because it's one of those books that I knew a lot more about this particular subject when I'd finished it than when I started. I'm quite well read in regards to the supernatural, but there were a lot of aspects, especially in regards to Scandinavia and Germanic lore and certain stories, as we mentioned, from Italy as well earlier, that I'd never heard of, Stephen. So I thank you for bringing these to our attention.
It was really a pleasure, a work of love.
So what's next for you? I know you've alluded to that. Are you continuing to write your articles and work on other projects going forward, Stephen?
Probably won't be doing too much in the way of articles, but like I say, I'm heavily involved in research and something that I think your listeners would really love. And I'm not allowed to say it because I blurted it out on another podcast and I heard about it later.
Yeah. That's quite all right. We'll keep your secret safe. So, Stephen, before I let you go, where can everybody find you online and get hold of a copy of this book and any of your previous works you'd like to mention, sir?
Well, of course, this book, you can order it from Llewellyn. They have a lot of good books there. You probably get lost in their catalog. And, of course, the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and hopefully at your local bookstore. For me, I'm on Facebook under Stephen J. Rolfus. And my son keeps that up and, with all my latest events.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to both in the show notes so people can track down a copy. And as I said, I recommend anybody with a love of folklore or history or just generally spookiness would be well within themselves to get a copy of this, because it's a brilliant book. And I just want to say thank you again for such a wonderful and intriguing conversation, Stephen. And I wish you and your family the very best for the rest of the year.
Thank you. The very best to you and your family.